Sister Christian, oh, the time has come.
Hello, you know this is Peter Fisher, and this is week 16 of the General One podcast.
Okay.
Today we'll be talking about the hydrogen atom.
Where you going, what you looking for? You know those boys don't want to play no more with you. It's true.
The motor is... So it's just now 3 weeks before General One, and, at this point, you should be spending quite a bit of time studying and remember, not just working problems, but you should have a list of things that from doing problems and from old exams that you're not sure you understand that you're going through systematically. And as you go through these things, be sure to think about the connections that whatever topic you have has with other things, because if you go back and remember to the earlier podcasts, one of the main things about studying for General One is to systematize your knowledge of physics. Now, it would be a good idea sometime in the coming week to take one of the old General One exams, hopefully one that you haven't worked with yet, and sit down and do the exam in battle conditions, meaning sit down and take the exam the way you will take it on the 28th, which is in 1 5-hour period of time with no books or notes. And now would be a good time for me to mention a few of the specifics of the exam and to give you some tips on how to take the exam. The exam has 20 questions that are in 5 groups of 4 questions, and each group is graded by a different person. And the exam booklets that you will have are loose sheets of paper, and you're asked to keep them grouped. At least this was done in the past. Now, when you work a problem, you should work each problem on a fresh sheet of paper. You should start by drawing a clear diagram of the physical layout. Be sure to clearly label the problem and really try to write neatly. I've graded these exams sometimes, and you know, some people just have amazingly poor ability of organizing their thinking on a piece of paper, and terrible handwriting and little scribbled drawings and algebraic steps that don't follow one after the other. And remember, the object is to pass, and you know, passing is not 100%. It's, you know, probably somewhere around 50%. So partial credit means a lot. And the clearer your thinking is, the easier it is for the grader to give you partial credit. So when you sit down to take the exam, try to practice systematic, clear, expository work. So whoever is grading the problem has some clue that you know something and can give you some partial credit. That's really important. The other thing is to employ the usual exam strategies of working the easy problems, you know, the ones you're able to do first, and then coming back to the harder problems. Remember that the people making up the exam know that you're going to have 5 hours to take the exam, and that means 15 minutes per problem. So you are not going to be able to be asked to carry out long algebraic manipulations. You're not going to be able be asked to diagonalize 4x4 matrices, or probably even 3x3 matrices, unless they're pretty simple ones. So you should really be on the lookout for anything that's getting computationally complex, and stop and make sure that you know what you're doing and not going off down some, you know, random blind alley. when you go through the exam, it might be a wise idea just to read each problem first and then mark them, you know, zero plus or minus, plus for the ones you know you can do, zero for the ones you might be able to do, and minus for the ones that are really going to be difficult, and act accordingly. And above all, try to be neat and clear in your thinking. I'm not saying you should write beautifully annotated problem solutions, but if you put down Schrödinger's equation, be sure to make it legible and all in one place. Make it clear what you do and don't know. So in the next week, try to find a five-hour block of time where you can really sit down and take a practice exam in an uninterrupted way. This week is the second of three podcasts on quantum mechanics, and today we're going to talk mostly about the hydrogen atom and use that as lead-in for a few things like perturbation theory and separating differential equations. The hydrogen atom is in many ways, really the cornerstone of quantum mechanics. It was the first serious problem that was solved, and it's one of the few atomic systems that really admits a nearly complete solution. And you should really know it. I'm not saying you should know every equation and all the manipulations in detail, but you should know what has and has not been done with the hydrogen atom, and have some fluency at carrying out quantum mechanical calculations for the hydrogen atom. Of course, it starts with the Bohr model, and amazingly, you can get a lot of mileage out of the Bohr model. The Bohr model was really based around a few postulates. First of all, the electron in orbit didn't really radiate, and just orbited in a circular fashion under the Coulomb potential. The second postulate is that the orbits are not like Keplerian orbits, but are circular and quantized in units of Planck's constant, h-bar. The third is that, of course, the electron doesn't radiate. A good problem to do is to calculate the time it would take an electron to fall to the surface of the proton if it did radiate, using the Lamour radiation expression for radiation of a particle under constant acceleration. Radiation is allowed when the electron changes states. The states are the discrete orbits that are multiples of Planck's constant. And so the angular momentum is equal to n times h-bar. And then the second equation that takes care of everything is that there's the balance between the Coulomb force and the centripetal acceleration. Solving that for r and v gives an expression for a naught, which is the Bohr radius, and the velocity. And so one thing, and also what emerges out of this sort of for the very first time, is alpha, the fine structure constant, which is e squared over h bar c, or 1 over 137. So something you should just know is that the velocity in the lowest orbit is alpha times C. And A naught is equal to H bar squared divided by mass of the electron times E squared. And you should probably just memorize those or be able to derive them very, very quickly. The energy levels come out to be equal to the energy levels come out to be equal to minus 13.6 electron volts times Z squared divided by N squared. And the 13.6 is mc squared divided by 2 of the rest energy of the electron times alpha squared. So this is really marks the first appearance of the fine structure constant. And you can see it arises very, very naturally out of the Bohr atom. From here, you can calculate the wavelengths of all of the emitted radiation, the Balmer, Paschenbach series lines, and Lyman alpha as well, from hydrogenic transitions. Notice that unlike the full quantum mechanical treatment, there's only one quantum number, which is the principal quantum number N. Technically speaking, the mass that appears is the reduced mass between the electron and proton, which, given that the proton weighs 2,000 times more than the electron, is really just the electron mass. So the connection between the Bohr model and the Wilson-Sommerfeld quantization rule is fairly obvious, but you should make sure you understand that. You should also make sure that you understand the failings of the Bohr model, which are obvious. The ad hoc nature of the quantization and the fact that there's nothing about how you calculate the transition rates between the levels inside of the Bohr atom. The major refinement, of course, comes from the full quantum mechanical treatment using the Hamiltonian p squared over 2m plus e squared over r, which results in a differential equation for the wave function psi, which is minus h bar over 2m del squared minus z times e squared over r, all operating on psi, giving e times psi, where e is the energy level. The next step is to use separation of variables to write the wave function as psi, which is a function of r, theta, and phi in spherical coordinates, as the product of a radial wave function r times a angular wave function theta times an angular, the azimuthal wave function phi. The equations are easily separated and fairly easy to solve. I'm not going to read them out because they're certainly in every book. The important thing that you should know is that if you find yourself trying to separate the wave equation, the Schrodinger equation in spherical coordinates on the exam, you've taken a wrong term. That's really just much more than you would be asked to do on a general exam. What you should know is that the angular part has solutions that are the spherical harmonics, y, and there are two quantum numbers associated with them, L and M sub L. L is the angular momentum and runs from 0 to infinity, and M sub L is the projection of the angular momentum and runs from minus L to L. And Y is a function of theta and phi, and you should know that the Y's form an orthogonal system of coordinates and orthogonal functions. And also the integral rules for integrals of product of three phi's, which are, if they have quantum numbers L, L prime, and L double prime, and M sub L prime, and M sub L double prime, then, for example, M sub L has to be equal to M sub L prime plus M sub L double prime, and L is equal to the absolute value of L prime minus L double plus L double prime all the way down to L prime minus L double prime absolute value. The radial wave function is a product of a exponential term, which is e to the minus r times a constant that involves a naught, an r to the l part, and then the Laguerre polynomials. And I would say that for practical purposes, what you should just know are the wave functions for L equals 0 and L equals 1. Those are pretty easy to memorize and fairly easy to manipulate. Just for completeness, I'll mention that you determine the radial wave functions by forming a series which terminates. And you've all probably gone through exercises like that. So as an exercise, you should really work through at least once the whole series of manipulations coming up with the L equals, or I'm sorry, N equals 0 and N equals 1 wave functions explicitly, both the theta phi part and the r part. And from there, extract the energy eigenvalues and see that the energy eigenvalues are independent of L and only depend on N. Of course, we'll talk about perturbation theory in just a minute, and that lifts a lot of the degeneracies. You should also take this opportunity to see that the eigenfunctions are have principal quantum numbers N, L, and M sub L, and that L is always less than or equal to N, and M sub L runs from plus L to minus L. Now, that done would sort of really finish it for the hydrogen atom, except, of course, there are additional effects, and in order to incorporate the additional effects, which I'll express in a moment, one needs to use perturbation theory. Starting with time-independent perturbation theory, these are static perturbations, and you've certainly seen this. Perturbation theory works on the basic idea that one has a Hamiltonian H0 with a complete set of solutions, which we'll designate by cat n. So H naught cat n equals En cat n. And then one is going to apply a perturbing potential, lambda times V, where V is the perturbation. And in general, it would be impossible to exactly solve the full Schrodinger equation or full Hamiltonian given by H naught plus lambda times V. So one makes use of the fact that V is in general small in comparison with H naught, resulting in small corrections to the energy in comparison with En. And to lowest order, the energy shift, delta N, of the nth energy eigenvalue is going to be given by lambda times the amplitude bra N V ket N. So just the V sandwiched between the two relevant energy eigenvalues of H naught. The wave function N will be modified by a term that's equal to lambda times the sum of terms labeled by K not equal to N, and each term is ket N times VKN divided by EN minus EK. So let me explain that. The first term is just one of the kth solution to H naught K equals E sub K times ket K. VKN is bra K V ket N, and that's divided by the energy denominator, which is the difference between the states of the two energies, EN and EK. And one sums over all solutions except the nth solution, and then adds that to the nth solution. So that's the lowest order correction. And higher order very quickly becomes complicated, and I would say that if you're asked to do something, or if you find yourself trying to do something past higher first order, it'd be good to ask. Note that the wave function I just gave you, or not the wave function, but the states I just gave you, are not normalized. So you have to take the perturbed wave function and explicitly normalize it to 1. So that's the basic idea of non-degenerate first-order perturbation theory. The basic idea is that the energies just change a little bit by the perturbation, and the perturbation mixes the energy eigenvalues a little bit. One can readily apply this to the hydrogen atom. Let me give you just a little example that's not the hydrogen atom. Take the harmonic oscillator, which is p squared divided by 2m plus 1/2 m omega squared x squared, and then add a perturbation which just serves to change the potential a little bit. So the perturbation is 1/2 epsilon m omega squared x squared. And from there, work out the change to the energies and the change to the energy, or change to the eigenvalues. Now, in general, a perturbation V will not change all of the energies, and there will be degeneracies. And when that happens, what one needs to do is to find a new set of basis energy states. A good starting example that you should work through is the linear Stark effect, and this is actually something that could show up on a general exam. The linear Stark effect is the application of an electric field as a perturbation. The form of the perturbation is V equals minus E times Z times E naught, where E naught is the magnitude of the electric field, Z is the Z coordinate, and E is the electric charge. So this is just the application of electric field in the Z direction to the hydrogen atom. Now, thinking classically, you know what's going to happen. The proton's going to be pushed along the Z-axis, And in the positive direction, the electron's going to be pushed in the negative direction. And what's going to result is an overall polarization to the atom. And also remember that perturbation theory relies on the perturbation being small in comparison with the main Hamiltonian. And so you should work out for the dimensions of the hydrogen atom how small this electric field has to be. So applying first-order perturbation theory to the ground state, what you need to calculate is bra zero, little e times z times e naught ket zero. E and E naught, the electric charge and electric field, are constants. So what you need to calculate is the expectation value of the Z coordinate for the ground state wave function, which is of course zero. And you should get used to thinking of these symmetries, because carrying out that calculation would take some minutes. Actually, it'd take quite a long time, because you'd have to write Z as equal to R cosine theta, and then there would be two integrals, a radial integral and an angular integral, and the angular integral would quickly evaluate to zero. The radial integral would not. So you want to recognize that because it's a spherically symmetric wave function, the expectation value of Z is not zero. Now, if one thinks of the, and of course this state will not mix with any of the other states, because there's only one state with principal quantum number n equals one. For n equals two, there are actually four states: the s state and the three p states, and so there are going to be, in fact, a total of 16 different matrix elements, all of them sandwiching Z. And this is something that would be pretty reasonable to ask on a general exam. So what you will need to do is find a new set of basis vectors, or energy eigenstates, by diagonalizing a 4x4 matrix. Now this goes very, very quickly. I'm not going to go explicitly through the calculation, but I can tell you that there's only one integral that you actually need to do, and the resulting 4x4 matrix only has two non-zero entries, so it's relatively easy to diagonalize, and leads to a total of three different energy levels. The polarization factor, which is the perturbation between the 2s and 2p m equals zero states, is 3 times E times H naught times E naught, and that gives the splitting between the four different states. So that would be an excellent thing to work through, because it's something that's very frequently asked on general exams. The next application of time-independent perturbation theory is fine structure. This is the spin-orbit interaction, and this takes into account the interaction between the magnetic moment of the electron and the apparent magnetic field the electron sees, because the nucleus, or the proton, seems to be circling it, making a magnetic field. Again, this is something you've seen before. The interaction for the Hamiltonian for the spin-orbit interaction is equal to minus mu dot B effective, where B effective is the effective magnetic field given by the orbiting, the proton orbiting the electron from the electron's point of view. And the calculation of that is actually a little bit complicated, calculating the effective field. Requires a misapplication of relativity. The resulting calculation, though, gives the spin orbit perturbing Hamiltonian as a bunch of constants times L dot S, where L is the orbital angular momentum and S is the spin of the electron. Mu, the magnetic moment of the electron, is a vector, and that's equal to E over MC times S, where S is the vector of the electron polarization. I'm sorry, electron spin. So then the calculation really, aside from some constants, is really the expectation value or the amplitude of the L dot S term between the various states in the hydrogen atom in the N equals 0 and N equals 1. And the question is, what do you do to calculate L dot S? So there is actually a place where people go wrong. There are two different sets of quantum numbers. One are the quantum numbers of L squared, LZ, S squared, and SZ, and the others are L squared, S squared, J squared, and JZ. The first set would be very, very difficult because you'd have to calculate all the different mixtures between SZ states and LZ states. The trick is to use the fact that you can write L plus S as equal to the vector J, and then you square both sides, and you have J squared equal to L squared plus 2 L dot S plus S squared, and then bring everything over except L dot S, so you have L dot S is equal to J squared minus L squared minus S squared all times divided by 2. And so the eigenvalues of L squared are L times L plus 1, eigenvalues of S squared are S times S plus 1, and eigenvalues of J squared are J times J plus 1. So the real problem is how do you calculate, how do you add up all of those different interactions or perturbations. So S is always equal to S is always equal to 1/2. So the perturbing energy is going to be equal to 1/2 times J times J plus 1 minus L times L plus 1 minus 3/4 times a constant. And so that's the result. Now the constant that appears, which would be difficult to calculate, is 1 over m squared c squared times 1 over r times dv dr, where v is the Coulomb interactions. And then you have to calculate the radial expectation value of that, and it turns out the radial expectation value of 1 over r times dv dr is equal to e squared over a naught cubed. That's really something that would be beyond the scope of the exam, but I'm just mentioning it so that you know about it. So that's really just an example of a straight-up first-order perturbation. to the hydrogen atom wave function. The hydrogen atom energy spectrum. As an exercise, you can try working out the perturbed wave functions, or the perturbed eigenstates. So note that the spin orbit splitting is reduced by a factor of alpha squared from the unperturbed eigenvalues. Another interesting thing to work out is using the constants I just gave you for the sodium D lines, which are around 590 angstroms. Use this to calculate the splitting between the J equals 3/2 and J equals 1/2 sodium 3p states, which are, so sodium is like a hydrogen-like atom with one electron around the outside and 10 electrons in the outside. So the outer shell electron is normally in the 3s state, but there's also the 3p states. At the same level of approximation, there's the, this is referred to as fine structure, by the way. At the same level of approximation, there's the perturbation due to the relativistic mass correction, which just comes from the expansion of the kinetic energy. So the kinetic energy is equal, that appears in the Hamiltonian, is equal to the total energy E minus the rest energy mc squared. And E is, of course, equal to the square root of mc squared, square root of m squared c to the fourth plus p squared c squared. And taking the first two terms of expanding that square root and assuming that pc is smaller than mc squared, one gets p squared over 2m, which is what normally appears in the Hamiltonian, minus p to the fourth divided by 8m cubed c squared. And so as an exercise, calculate the energy shift due to the p to the fourth over 8m cubed c squared term. There's a trick that needs to be employed that I'll come to later. The next classical application is the Zeeman effect, and this is what happens when you apply a magnetic field to a hydrogen atom. The magnetic field interacts with the orbiting magnetic field and makes a perturbation that looks like some constants times LZ plus 2SZ. So one needs to calculate the expectation values of those things. And again, you can employ the use of the total angular momentum J to write LZ plus 2SZ equal to JZ plus SZ. So you need to couple the states under consideration into total angular momentum and SZ. There's some constants in front, and they aren't very interesting. The constants are minus E times the magnitude of the magnetic field divided by 2MEC. So again, this can be an application of degenerate perturbation theory, and you can go ahead and calculate the new wave function, the new energy eigenfunctions and energy shifts. And this appears at the next order of corrections. Now, it's important to know what quantum numbers are good in various regimes. Always good are L squared, S squared, and JZ. in the case where the magnetic field is very weak, J squared or L dot S is almost a good set of quantum numbers. And when the magnetic field becomes very strong, LZ and SZ are almost good quantum numbers. And you should understand what I mean by almost good. It means that at this order of perturbations, they are good approximations to the always good quantum numbers. So as an exercise, work through all of the Zeeman effect for the 2s and 2p states. It's pretty straightforward calculation. Don't worry about calculating the constants. Nobody's going to ask you how to do that. A final thing that's probably a little bit beyond the scope of anything is the calculation of the van der Waals interaction between two hydrogen atoms. And here the unperturbed Hamiltonian is the Hamiltonian for the two hydrogen atoms at infinite separation. And then the perturbing Hamiltonian is the interaction, there are actually four of them, between the two electrons, two protons. And it's actually quite a difficult calculation, but if you were ambitious and wanted to really understand how two neutral atoms interact, it's a worthwhile thing to do. Time-dependent perturbation theory is very tricky, except in the case of two state systems, which we'll talk about next time, and in the case of first order transitions, which is an application of Fermi's golden rule. And so I think next time when we talk about two state systems, we'll talk a lot about time-dependent perturbation theory. Probably for anything anyone's going to ask you to do with the hydrogen atom, starting with Fermi's golden rule, which says the transition probability between states of a state going from state I to state N is equal to 2 pi divided by h bar times the amplitude bra n v ket I squared times delta e n minus e I. So all you really need to do is be able to calculate the matrix element of the perturbing potential. The one hard part in the case of this is what the perturbing in the case of transitions are for the hydrogen atom is what the perturbing potential is. The perturbing potential is the classical radiation field. So the perturbing potential has the form of minus E divided by M times C times A dot P, where A is the vector potential, and that's where the electric field gets taken care of. And the vector potential looks like a monochromatic plane wave, so it's equal to 2 times the magnitude A naught times a polarization vector epsilon hat times cosine with the phase omega divided by C n hat dot x minus omega t, where n hat is the direction of propagation, and there's the polarization, and omega is the angular frequency. What one typically does is write A as, or the cosine term in terms of a sum of two terms, e to the I omega over c n hat dot x minus I omega t plus e to the minus I omega over c. One corresponds to absorption, the other corresponds to emission, And so that becomes the perturbing potential, and it's the expectation value of the, or the transition value, A dot P, that you need to calculate. Now, in general, if one wants to calculate, for example, the lifetime of the 2P state, so the 2P to 1S transition, which you should work through, you should recognize that the wavelength of that photon is large compared with the atom. So the term in the vector potential, e to the I omega divided by c n hat dot x, can be expanded in powers of omega. So that's going to be equal to, because omega divided by c is 1 over lambda, so where lambda is the wavelength. So as lambda gets large, those successive terms get small. So that's going to be equal to 1 plus I omega c n hat dot x plus, and then higher order terms. And so you can really stop at the n hat dot x term. So, and you should verify that numerically. So what one really needs to calculate is bra n, and then the perturbation is some constants, polarization vector epsilon hat dot p, the momentum vector, ket I. That's what comes out of the this dipole approximation that we're making. And since the polarization vector is a constant, what you really only need to calculate is bra n p vector ket I, which you can do. And if you know the 2p and 1s wave functions, you can apply the momentum operator to the 1s wave function and then carry out the integral. That's really a bit of a pain, and there's a trick. You can make use of the fact that the commutation relation between x and h naught, the unperturbed Hamiltonian, is equal to I h bar over m times px, etc. So you can reduce the calculation of bra n ket p, bra n p ket I, to bra n x ket I, which is a much easier calculation, and then use symmetry arguments to carry out the calculation. So once that's done, you can calculate either transmission or absorption. As an assignment, you should just calculate the lifetime of the 2p state for the 2p to 1s transition. The answer is about 1.6 nanoseconds, and it's a relatively easy calculation. The other thing you can do is calculate the absorption probability, and just make use of the definition of cross-section, which is the energy per unit time absorbed by the atom divided by the energy flux of the radiation field. And carrying out that calculation, you should be able to find the absorption cross-section in the dipole approximation. These are both excellent examples to work through. Finally, there's the photoelectric effect, which is just the ejection of the electron from the atom entirely. And for that, the calculations are all exactly the same as the photoelectric absorption, except the final state, N, is a electron plane wave state. And once you've gone through all of the stuff, you can pretty easily isolate the correct term. Again, this is a more complex calculation than you would normally be expected to do, but in working through it, you should see all the things that you might be asked. For example, suppose you have a hydrogen atom prepared L equals 1, M sub L equals 1 state, and that undergoes a transition to the L equals 0, M sub L equals 0 state. What is the polarization of the emitted photon? What is the angular distribution of the emitted photon? Then you can be asked all the things in reverse. Suppose you have an atom in the 1s state, and you shine a photon along the x-axis with polarization along the y-axis. What is the direction of the emitted electron, and so on. So in working through these, and you should work through the three things that I just mentioned in detail, think about, you know, the physical circumstances. What direction does the photon likely come out? What's the likely polarization? Another good exercise, and this actually can go quite quickly, is to calculate all of these things, not for the hydrogen atom, but for the for a bound harmonic oscillator. So instead of binding by the Coulomb potential, this is bound by the harmonic oscillator potential. Another interesting Fermi-Golden rule calculation to do is the lifetime of the hyperfine interaction. So the proton also has a spin, and in the ground state, the proton spin and electron spins can be aligned or anti-aligned, and so there's a transition, which is a spin-flip transition that's highly suppressed. This gives rise to the 21 centimeter radiation. But it's instructive to go through and try to work out how to the lifetime of the higher energy of the true states. For those of you in astrophysics, you probably know all about the 21 centimeter radiation. This is pervades the galaxy from large clouds of hydrogen, and is in fact used to map the spiral arms of the Milky Way. The lifetime is millions or billions of years, and the reason you see it at all is it's collisionally excited by hydrogen in the interstellar medium, which, you know, occasionally bumps into some other hydrogen and flips it or causes it to emit. So that's it for a very quick tour of the hydrogen atom. Be sure when you're thinking about the hydrogen atom not to concentrate so much on some of the more arcane mathematical manipulations. Keep in mind the big picture, the primary constants involved, A naught, alpha, and the Rydberg, and selection rules, and the application of time-independent degenerate perturbation theory and non-degenerate perturbation theory to the main things, to the operators themselves. Don't worry about working out the constants.
Every bottom of the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed.
Coming from Logan Airport. I'm on my way to Stanford, to Slack, actually, and I found a quiet corner of the airport, although it's a little bit disturbing. You can hear Highway to Hell playing in the background, and it's just coming out of the laptop of someone that looks like an airline pilot. Not American, which is my flight, which is probably good. Anyway, this week in science, there is a special section on astroparticle physics, which I recommend all of you in particle physics and astronomy, or astrophysics, have a look at. Several interesting things are mentioned. One is there's a really lousy survey of dark matter experiments by Bernard Sadoulay. Sadoulay is this French guy who's a professor at Berkeley. And he's really just kind of a spaz, and I'm thinking of actually writing a letter to the editor
complaining about his article. In a nice way, of course. And I'll send him the letter first in case he wants to make corrections. There's also an article about an experiment called Ice Cube, which is a successor to an experiment called Amanda at the South Pole. And the idea is they drill down into the ice and put in these long strings of photon detectors and use those to look for neutrino interactions in the ice itself, which sounds like a really keen idea, except it's very complicated. The neutrinos have to be very high energy, and I think that Amanda actually never saw something that they knew was a neutrino interaction. Ice Cube is much larger and expects to see the neutrinos from the process that we talked about earlier. Remember, I gave you a problem to calculate the interaction of a proton with a microwave background photon, that, you know, one of the 3-degree photons, to make a delta resonance. The delta resonance then decays to a proton and a pion. The pion very quickly then decays to a muon and neutrino. And these neutrinos are called Grison neutrinos. They're very high energy, about 10 to 15, 16 electron volts. And Ice Cube is sort of guaranteed to see them, which sounds really cool. But you know, one question I have is, you know, who cares? This cutoff, as I mentioned in another podcast, has been observed by an experiment called Fly's Eye. And I think the Auger experiment is about to announce an observation. And Ice Cube will measure the neutrinos, which, you know, is an important verification. But an interesting question to ask is, you know, is this really important science? Now, maybe I'm wrong. You know, obviously, I don't think it's terrifically important. But, you know, I could be wrong, and we keep an open mind. And you should, too. You should, if you're interested in these things, look at these articles and you know, really think, why is this important? Just because it's a big article in Nature or Science doesn't mean it's something that's really very important. There is hype everywhere. Along the same note, this is a very good time to be going to seminars, because this is sort of hiring season. Every year we have searches for new junior faculty members, and I think this year every division in the physics department, and there are four divisions in case you didn't know. There's my division, Nuclear and Particle Experiments. There's the Center for Theoretical Physics. There's the Astrophysics Division, and there's Condensed Matter, Atomic Physics, and Plasma Physics, kind of the other division. Each of these divisions is having searches, and for junior faculty. And when you have a search, you know, you take all the applications and you sort of winnow it down to, you know, 3 to 10 people, and then you invite those 3 to 10 people to come and give a talk about what they do. And at the same time, they go around and meet everybody. And these talks can be really, really very interesting. They also can be really lousy. But it's probably a good idea for you to go to these, because in not too many years, say 7 or 8, you're going to be going around giving talks to get a faculty position. And it's never too early to start practicing. These are people who, you know, who are really the best people in their fields, and they're going to come and tell you about what they're doing. And it's a great time to show up and ask questions, and, you know, give them a hard time if they're doing something you're interested in, and you think they're talking cheese. You know, go and call them on it. You know, nobody's going to write your name down, you know, except in a good way. So it's a good time of year. The way you can tell it's a job talk is it's usually a special seminar, because the regular seminars are usually planned a few months in advance, and so by the time the search committees come up with their short lists, usually special extra seminars have to be scheduled. And they're posted, and it's perfectly okay to go. In fact, it's good for you to go.
Everybody knows a good thing. guys lost. Everybody knows that the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor and the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
So that's it for this week. Next week we're going to talk about two state systems and further review of time-independent, time-dependent perturbation theory. And remember, between now and next week, try to sit down and take an exam in vital conditions and let me know how it comes out. Either comment to the website or an email to me, fisherp@mit.edu. After that, there'll just be one podcast, which I'm going to post this Saturday before the exam, with sort of last-minute tips and ideas. You should really be pushing hard now. This is the really big crunch time. And I'm sure you'll do fine. What I've been thinking about is a podcast following this one, maybe take a two-week break, to talk about organizational things. Not just filing and stuff like that, but a bigger organizational picture. I've been reading a lot and practicing some new organizational techniques related not just to work, but also to home life and spiritual life. I hope that doesn't sound scary. So if you're interested in this, drop me a line, let me know. And it'll be linked to a lot of other organizational sites and podcasts. And it will be specifically oriented at people pursuing academic careers. So this will be good for you, and probably for a wider audience. As always, I'd like to thank Sheila Holzer-Marston for the continuing hard work and support, along with her husband John for all the work on the website, and Maynard Galinas and Sean Thompson from the LNS Computational Facility for helping with disk space and providing computers and so on, and Bonna Newman and Homer Reed at RAS for the encouragement and advertising. And until next week, study hard and have a good time here in Cambridge or wherever you are. Take care.
Cotton for your ribbons and bows, everybody knows. Everybody knows that the plague is coming. Everybody knows that it's moving fast. Everybody knows that your naked man and woman are just a shining artifact of the past. Everybody knows the scene is dead, but there's gonna be a meter on your bed that will disclose what everybody knows. Everybody knows you're in trouble. Everybody knows what you've been through. From the blood that cross on top of Calvary to the beach of Malibu. Everybody knows it's coming apart. Take one last look at this mighty heart. The